Dimitri, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it as always for taking the time.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
So I love talking to you because you are such a straight shooter. You started off with a company named Alice. If you're in the hospitality industry, you know exactly what that is. And if you are not familiar yet, you should be soon, is a company called Arbor. And we'll jump into that soon. But Dimitri, just want to get kicked off here by talking about your background and getting to know a little bit about you. So you mind walking us through just you and your story real quick?
Yeah. So I'm a kid who always wanted to be an inventor, and it took me a while to figure out how to do that. I think I lacked the courage and the belief in myself early on, and it took me a lot of turns to kind of land to where I am today. I started as really a software engineer. I came from Ukraine when I was 9, and everyone in my community eventually went into software, and so it's like, well, this is what I'm going to do. And it was a great experience. And it was kind of the first time that I got to touch entrepreneurship. And the first time I touched it, it really scared the crap out of me, I got to say. So I did it would be called an incubator or a venture lab when I was 18. I was in college and this guy hired me to work on all these different domains that he owned. And we're talking about big domains like medication stuff and carrentals.com. And so eventually it would become carrentals.com, but I couldn't see how innovation is birthed, and the lack of structure was mad to me. Like, I needed to have specific problems that I could solve. And after working in that spot for a year, I just felt like I was constantly spinning and I didn't know how to bring new ideas to life. And so I went on the complete opposite end, and I worked in finance for a decade. First at Morgan Stanley, and then at a large hedge fund, where I ran trading and quantitative analytics on the tech side. And I remember watching David, who ran this incubator, pivot and pivot and eventually find carrentals.com, of which I would have been the first employee if I was there, and grow it to be this massive juggernaut, sell it to Expedia. And it was really inspirational. And so while I'm sitting there in finance and getting pretty deep into it, I just started to see that I wanted to go beyond the transactionality of a business, and I wanted to touch humans, not numbers only. And I actually started working on a startup to the side. And it's in like this classic way where my buddy and I were building this system to help neurosurgeons navigate the brain with brain imagery. We knew nothing about neurosurgery. We knew very little about how a radiologist interacts any of the DICOM data. And most importantly, we didn't talk to any of them. So it was like the trifecta of what early stage founder, but in our heads, it was like, we're going to make the best business ever. And a great thing came out of that business. After 2 years of working on something that was effectively a hobby. Fun fact, if you're working on a business and you don't have any customers or a path to monetization, it is a hobby. A business only becomes a business when people will pay you for it. It doesn't mean that the hobby can't be fun. It doesn't mean that you can't learn from your hobby. There are plenty of incredible hobbies, but it's a hobby unless there are customers on the other side that are saying, I need this thing. And we did not have that. What we had was effectively interesting idea that led us to something you know very well, which is startup leadership program. I wound up shutting the business down. No, he wound up shutting the business down. He called me one day and he said, this is dumb. We don't have any customers. We don't know what we're doing. And so why don't we spend our time pursuing something that could actually be effective? And I learned all of this in this fellowship. You should do the fellowship. And then maybe you'll find a way to do a business that actually people do care about. And so that was kind of me dipping my toe in. I was still in finance. I was still working my 12 to 14 hours and trying to think about how I'm going to be the CTO of a hedge fund. Even touching entrepreneurship, this would be over 10 years after I first started in college, I started to see that, you know what, it's not that random. And maybe there's an opportunity to create something. And it was really, really exciting. And so I got into this fellowship, started to meet a bunch of founders, and through that got connected to these two guys starting Alice, an investor that we both mutually knew, connected us. And I was really captivated by both them and the idea. I thought, hey, here's an opportunity to work with humans to help people deliver hospitality. This is a complete about face from, you know, the transactionality of what I was doing. It was interesting to me. And so for about 9 years, we built this global hospitality brand. We eventually had think 18 time zones, people all over the world. We were servicing more than half of the world's top hotels, like Forbes hotels. And we eventually sold the company to Expedia. We raised over $50 million. And it was this wild ride that I never expected to have. And if you would have told the 18-year-old me that was scared shitless in the incubator that you're going to be doing a startup, I would have never believed it. And so I think you just have to mature into being ready for the lack of structure. And some people are ready at 15. I was not. I don't think I was really ready till my 30s. And similar here, after selling the company, I had this life experience where I wanted to record my grandmother's stories. And so I learned what it takes to record human stories. And in doing so, I effectively was doing documentary filmmaking, although I didn't really know it at the time. And it took me about 6 months to learn how to do it. And eventually, when I sat down to actually record the story, it was too late. She passed away. She got pancreatic cancer. And for me, this was an opportunity to reflect and say, why did it take so long? And I am a perfectionist. And so like I did want to get it right, but also it was hard. Doing video and recording people's stories was something that you don't just hit a button and you do. You got to learn how to connect with people, how to find great moments, how to take photos and add them in. So I had all these skills and I wanted to use them towards something. And so I went out to my friends, said, lend me your parents. Let me record their stories. I went out and recorded my parents' stories. And that's how the first version of Arbor was born. We started to record family history and we raised a capital on it. We got some incredible people to join. And then over the course of a few years, we recorded over 1,000 family stories. And we started to, or just over 1,000 stories. And we started to work with some non-families, saw a really interesting opportunity to do something totally new. So specifically, we started working with nonprofits. And in recording their stories, it was still had that power, that impact, but it also had an urgency that we didn't see on the family side. A lot of the families that we recorded stories for, they were super excited about having the recordings, and they were going to watch it next year. They were going to watch it at the reunion. And we were like emailing them saying, how is it? How is it? We care so much about this. And they're like, not yet. We'll tell you later. And so it was very interesting to see an important product that didn't have urgency. And so, you know, like the Eisenhower matrix where you have like important and urgent. And what I learned is that great companies are in the important and urgent quadrant. And there's a lot of companies that are important, but they're not necessarily urgent. And if something's not urgent, it can be purchased tomorrow. It can be used tomorrow. It can be shared with others tomorrow. And so you don't really get that loop that you need as a startup to grow. And we were seeing that opportunity 100x on the nonprofit side while still having that same mission of helping people tell stories. And what we saw in the nonprofit side was this incredible opportunity to go even beyond sharing stories, but to create impact. And so the big kind of 360 view of this is the nonprofit industry is massive. It's one that I never understood how big it was. One of my favorite things is to talk to venture capitalists who are dismissive about this and say, well, before even starting, how big do you think the nonprofit sector is? And they'll say, you know, like 50 billion, maybe 100 billion. And the number is 2.4 trillion just in the US. It's a massive, massive, one out of 10 employees in the US work for a nonprofit. It's just not a sexy industry per se, but also not, it doesn't necessarily mean no profit. It just means you're taking profit and you're putting it into impact. And so we saw this incredible opportunity effectively to shift our focus and we recast our mission to turn stories into impact. And what we learned in the nonprofit sector was that for them, it was urgent because storytelling was their product. For a for-profit company, you have a product and people pay you for it. In a nonprofit company, if you're doing a service, you're helping somebody with meals or you're supporting cancer patients, a lot of times you're giving your product away for free. So what do you get paid for? You get paid for the story about what you did. It has to be a real story. You have to have real impact. But the commodity, end of the day, that gets paid for in a nonprofit is storytelling. And when you engage in discussions with fundraisers, the development teams, as they're called in nonprofits, they will all say that we deal in storytelling. We have to tell about the story of our org, about our programs, about our donors, about our beneficiaries. And that is what moves the needle. And so we started to dig even more in that. Like, what's the fascinating stuff? Like, there's a Stanford study that shows that there was a campaign on, I think it was Feed the Children, and they put stats out, 20,000 kids are going hungry and passing away every day. Please give. We help with this. And then they did another story that was more, let me tell you the story of one child that went hungry and passed. The story about the stats, I think, brought in like $1.14 average donation, and the story about the child was $2.36. It was this significantly higher number, and there's a reason there, because giving is tied to emotions, and emotions do not get activated with statistics. And so we started to see that there's this really interesting opportunity for us to use storytelling and emotions in order to create impact. And so in many ways, that's where we shifted Arbor. And then as we started talking to the development teams, what do you do with your stories? Like, well, we have to share them on social. And how? Well, we have to turn them into text, and we have to turn them into newsletters and emailers, and we have to talk about them at events. And so we started to model Arbor on the technology side after all of the needs that the people on the other side had. So, like, I'm a big proponent of the jobs to be done theory. And so what were the jobs to be done? I have a great story. I now need to go to a gala and talk about it. So I need talking points. I need to throw out some quotes on Instagram. Great. I need images. I need to put it onto my email. I need copy. I need to throw it up on LinkedIn. I need short clips. And so once you know the job, then you start to reverse engineer and you build the platform that does all of these things. And so that's where we kind of walk from personal storytelling into really personal storytelling with focus and a mission to help these great organizations that do incredible work, from, you know, Teach for America, Canadian Cancer Society, to small, incredible organizations in New York that donate wheelchairs to disabled children so they can become the incredible athletes they were always meant to be, like the JDJ Foundation. There's so much good that's happening in the world. And the thing that I'm excited about is we get to apply technology and AI to help more good happen. And kind of tying back the bow, going back to the 18-year-old me, if I told myself I'd be a CEO of a company, I'd be doubly surprised. Even doing a startup was nuts, but being the CEO was something that I would have never fathomed, not something I ever aspired to. But it just feels like I'm exactly in the right place, and this is exactly what I want to be doing.
I'm curious, because you, like you talked about briefly, SLP, which is Startup Leadership Program. That's how we met. I took part in your program, and it was unbelievable, changed the direction of our now company. And one of the things that I think I valued most from our conversations was you could always identify whether it was the founder themselves that needed to tweak certain things, or the business idea, or like the job to be done, like you were talking about. I'm curious, looking back, like when you're looking back on yourself, I'm sure the qualities were there and you might not have recognized it at the time. With SLP, how do you look at different founders and say, yeah, there's someone that should join our program, there's someone that should really benefit from becoming an entrepreneur, and we should be there to guide them?
It's really hard to tell who's going to be successful. And you can ask the venture capital industry, and their hit rate is 1 out of 20 for the people that are great at their job. So the way that we like to look at success is more not this company, not this moment, but do we think that this person is going to be somebody that can make it? And we think about entrepreneurship as a profession. And I actually think if you step away from the business right now as the point of success to the profession as a point of success, I think a lot of people can be really successful in entrepreneurship. And what it takes is resilience and curiosity. So the best founders, they're insatiable. They ask a ton of questions because they're trying to get the root cause that something isn't being done. If you think about, like, what is a startup? You're doing something that isn't done, or maybe not in the way that you're doing it, but there's a way that it's, there's a reason that's not happening. If you don't understand why something isn't being done, you might wind up doing it and realize it's not worth doing. And so the big thing that we look for is curiosity. And curiosity is often paired with self-awareness. So one of the things that, like, you should be curious about yourself before you can be too curious about the world. Because if you're curious about the world, but you're not curious about yourself, you're not going to see the world in an objective way. My therapist told me once, we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. And so if you think about the world, you and the truth, you are interpreting something. And if you can understand yourself, then you can calibrate your interpretation to understand what's actually happening. But people that are not self-aware, their ego is going to get in the way. They're going to try to cast something that may not actually be. And so when we interview people, we try to say, like, how curious are you? Have you demonstrated curiosity? How resilient are you? Have you gone through hard stuff? And how self-aware are you? Have you been met with failure and recognized it as failure? Or like, I'm a person that never fails. I mean, if you never fail, then your experiment has never concluded. Therefore, you've never learned anything. And I think in order to learn, you have to have failed. And there's a lot of things that we look for that show that an individual is able to see the world as it is, but also see themselves as they are, which is really a work in progress.
How do you calibrate yourself when you're considering the business that you're in? You, at a certain point, like you said, decided that you needed to slightly pivot, slightly adjust what you were doing. That's really hard to do, especially when I feel like as a founder, your view on everything gets so clouded because you're just thinking all the time.
It's really tough to calibrate, and you have to have the external world help you. So every step of the way in building your product, it's important to get feedback from those you're building it from. And that feedback can come in a lot of different ways. But as you get farther along the feedback cycle and you get closer to selling something, that feedback becomes more and more real. For instance, you go and you tell somebody, I have this idea. What do you think? A lot of times they'll say it's good. There's an entire book on this called The Mom Test, which shows you how we can convince ourselves that we are doing these customer discoveries, and all we're doing is asking for compliments. And one of the things the book said that I love is, if you're getting a compliment, you're fucking it up. If you're talking about your product, you shouldn't be looking for compliments. What you should be looking for is people saying, I have this problem. When can I use this product? If they're like, I love this product, this is really good, that's just a nice way of saying it's not relevant to me. And so there's all these markers, depending on how far you are. Once you have a product, are people buying it? And if they're buying it, are they using it? And if they're using it, are they getting the value that you thought that they would? I can't tell you how many founders think that their job is to build, and it's not. That their job is to deliver value. And in the process of delivering value, you come across a thing that hasn't been done. You've been curious enough to understand why it hasn't been done, and there's a good reason, and your approach, your technology can help get you to the other side. So you do it, and then you deliver that value. And then you see, did you do it? A lot of times people will throw their product out there and they say, people bought it, I'm done. No, you just begun. That is your thesis. Did it happen? And when people don't pay attention to whether the value is delivered, and they just pay attention to maybe if they've made some initial sales, 3 months later, 6 months later, they realize things aren't working. Why? Because they didn't check the actual point, which is you were asked to deliver value. Was that value delivered? And so there's a really great model that I saw at some like less lecture out of Harvard MBA that said there's a 2x2 of the thing and the way, which is you can do the right thing the right way, the right thing the wrong way, the wrong thing the wrong way, and the wrong thing the right way. And so if you kind of think about it as like the bottom quadrant as you're doing the wrong thing the wrong way. Every founder starts here because we're doing something new. And unless we hit a hole in one, which is very rare, we're going to start doing the wrong thing the wrong way. And then we're going to go and ask people if they like it. And we're going to get validation. And we're going to, in our heads here, this is awesome. You should do this. Like, look, I raised some money, which is not really an indicator that you can deliver value. It's just an indicator that you can convince people that you're an interesting person to fund, especially early on. And then you're going to start doubling down on your thing. So you're going to go from doing the wrong thing the wrong way to the wrong thing the right way. So you're very efficient at a thing that nobody cares about. And you know that because people aren't knocking down your doors. People aren't paying you, right? That's the only, like we talked about, difference between a hobby and a business is you get paid for a business and you just enjoy doing the hobby. So there's a lot of hobby startups out there because they're not trying to get paid. And so then you realize, wow, they're not paying me. I got to do something else. So now you drop down to doing the right thing in the wrong way. All of your processes go away. All the things you were efficient at, you're not efficient anymore. But you're doing something that people care about. And then you get this like incredible moment. I think the most important moment for a startup is when their customers complain. It's probably, to me, the most important thing that you can look for if your business is going well. You have irate customers. Have you ever been irate about a thing you didn't care about? The fact that a customer is angry at you means that they expect you to do better. And they're busy. Customers are busy all the time. So if they expect you to do better, they need what you do. And so the best sign that you have a good business early on is that you have angry customers. And then you listen to them and you figure out what you're doing wrong and you start doing the right thing the right way, right? So the wrong thing the wrong way, the wrong thing the right way, the right thing the wrong way, and then the right thing the right way. But a lot of people try to build ops and process around the wrong thing, and it doesn't matter because customers don't care and you don't get complaints. So you're like, oh my God, people love my product. No, they just don't care about your product. And so the crucible of every great company is to have irate customers, because when people are angry at you, you've built something that actually matters to them and they're willing to work with you to actually make it deliver the value that you intend to.
So you remind me of the book that you had me read many years ago when I did Startup Leadership. It was the Crossing the Chasm.
Yep. I think I overused Crossing the Chasm. Everyone at Alice was so, I would start saying the word crossing and you would just like feel a sea of eye rolls.
It was so useful for that exact reason. You're starting with people that like care. They're so willing to work with you.
And you like early on, the hardest part is reconciling the vision that you have with the value that your customer wants. Because it's never the same thing. You walk into this business seeing the world and you cast it fully and you get customers on board and they're like, cool, but we see a world this way. And finding that middle ground is excruciating. Because it's like remodeling your house every time. It's like, we want a multi-story house. I was building a ranch house. Wait, you want like a skyscraper? Oh, it's a resort town now, right? So like you're constantly re-architecting everything, but it's way better than being like, this is what I built. Who wants it? Because a lot of times the answer is nobody. And so being willing to re-architect, being willing to continue to find that middle point between your vision and what the customers want and listening to the pain that they have and having that inform how you shift is so, so valuable. And if you don't have anyone complaining about your product, you haven't hit anything that's valuable yet. And so waiting for that moment and rejoicing, even though it's awful, right? You have to like both be excited and scared shitless. And then somewhere in the middle of that is innovation.
So that's the part where you're getting customers and they're starting to give you feedback, et cetera. What about when that starts to change and now you're fixing the things that they want help with? You know, when do you make that transition to growth, or is there a step in between there that we're forgetting?
Give me a little bit more. I want to make sure I'm answering the question that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say and I'll use Lucia as an example. Like we have a lot of customers using us right now, especially in the early days. We were trying frantically to rebuild things, all different ways to figure out exactly how to deliver the value. We started getting real revenue, real traction. And we feel like now we're trying to figure out, okay, did we nail it? Is it time to now spend money into growing it? Or are we still going to need to fix 10 different things? Should we hold back on like throwing a ton of energy at growth, or should we still go to building mode?
Growth on sales or growth on internal process?
Growth on sales.
Yes. I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is a developer. And after spending a decade working in a startup, he had this epiphany and he said, you know, I realized that you can build almost anything, but you can't sell almost anything. And even though I was a hater on all of our sales team, I realized that they are the essential foundation upon which we build anything. And so I would say when you start to find something that people want, sales is just a function of saying, well, how much do they want it? And what is it specifically that they want? And you have to kind of walk the line of servicing the sale and accelerating the sale. But it's always better to have a ton of customers in the wing that are guiding you to what to build than to build with the belief that they will come when you are ready. Because it's always really hard to know whether you're swimming in a shallow pond or this pond actually comes from a major body of water that's right there and you just have to go. And that's again when that founder optimism comes in. One of the things that I've learned over and over again is being an effective founder is about having pragmatic optimism. You have to be able to see the world as it could be in the future and believe it enough to take the really low salary and the long hours and the massive stress of the unknown. But you also read signals from the world. You can't just be in a bunker on your own. And I think putting the gas pedal on sales, even for bursts, is a really good way to understand whether the thing that you're about to build and double down on is the thing that the customers want, right? Whether the vision that you have is the value that wants to be delivered and refining it. The best companies are conversation between vision and need. And that conversation is ongoing because needs change. It's very possible that your vision was really accurate today, but things have shifted now and the need is different tomorrow. And if you're in conversation, you'll start to see that very, very quickly and you'll change. If not, you say, hey, I got it. I know what I'm doing. I'll see you in a year. Well, maybe the conversation's changed in a year. And now you're back to doing the wrong thing in the right way. And because you've set up the ops, you have the product marketing, you have the engineering team is going, you know exactly your roadmap. You're going to keep going. But you're going to see the sales just aren't coming in, which simply means you're not building a thing people need anymore. And so I think there's a lot of danger in not doing sales. It has to continuously be a part of it. And you want to ramp it up and down based on capacity, but it's something that should always be in the world.
Love that. So I want to ask you, you have a lot of good lessons from SLP and I'm sure from just your day-to-day. Are there any stories, lessons, or just like pieces or nuggets that are your favorite to share with people that would be a good way to end on?
There's a guy named Mark that I should remember vividly, really smart guy, worked at a top five consulting company, and left in order to start a business that was the Uber for laundry. And he was doing really well, started to get an investor interest and understood exactly how to scale the business. And I remember talking to him one day and he said, I'm shutting it down. I said, what are you, you're shutting it down? Why? Like, well, I got up this morning and I answered a bunch of emails about missing laundry. And then I went to the factory and I talked to the people at the plant and tried to fix it. And then I got on a call with a few other owners. And I realized I fucking hate laundry people. So I'm done. And so it's really interesting to me that this is not a game of arbitrage. If you're a founder, you have to really enjoy the problem that you're solving. You have to really enjoy all the details, all the annoying parts, all the people, because if you're not, it's going to be really hard for you to be sufficiently curious to ask those questions that are going to make the difference. And he saw that. And that stayed with me. Right. When I think about Arbor, I love storytelling. I'm obsessed with it. We don't have time to go into this now, but I'm working on a musical for Broadway where I've been studying storytelling for like 15 years. I've been getting in rooms with actors and directors and producers and thinking about what makes a character interesting, what makes a scene work, what makes a plot effective. And to be able to apply that and train AI how to do that and build a platform that allows folks to do that at scale. I mean, this is so exciting. And on top of that, the reason I left finance is I wanted to be more human-centric, and the entire nonprofit world is all about serving humans. So I get to help organizations that I really care about while doing a thing that I really care about. So that's going to activate my curiosity in a massive way. And that's how I think as a founder, you know that you're doing a thing that you need to be doing because you legitimately care about the industry. The other day, I was chatting with a founder who is building a MarTech company. And I asked him what, we're talking about music, and I asked him what he likes to do for fun. He's like, I like to make ads for my friends' companies. It's like, what? It's like, yeah, I just find it so fun to build campaigns and think about how we can position it and everything from graphics always out. And he's building a MarTech company. That's somebody that is so curious because they just really care. That's somebody that's going to figure it out. And so I think that to me is the big lesson, which is lean into stuff that doesn't feel like work, the stuff that you're really just naturally connected to. And that's going to unlock a part of your brain that is going to lead you to do special things. Doing a startup is different than any other job that people have taken on. I saw this post once that said, 90% of your hires will be successful, just not at your company. And remembering that is excruciating and awful and true, especially if you're early on. you yourself don't know what you're doing. And so being conscious of that, that you need people who you don't know yet, and you need skill set that you don't fully realize, and giving yourself the grace that you're going to get it wrong. And so finding people early on that are agile and willing to mess things up and get their hands dirty, but also knowing that with all of that, you're still going to make a bunch of bad hires, and giving yourself the grace when that happens to try it again.
Is one of your, we talked a little bit about Broadway, your personal life, very little, but is there any specific lessons or stories from that world or that side of you that you love bringing into your work?
Ooh, I love that. So theater and startups are a lot more similar than they are different. And I would say the rooms of creation in theater are closer than the rooms of creation in a corporate America. And one thing that I learned in theater is that the vibe builds the idea. If you can create a space where people genuinely enjoy being with each other, and there's play, and there's an excitement and an alignment to what is being built, then you can be surprised. And one of the things that theater taught me and I brought back into management is the power of being surprised by a teammate is massive. I'm somebody that likes to understand all the positions, and I play the guitar and I write the music, and I would be working with a lot of musicians where I would be saying, okay, this is how this part goes, this is how the song goes. And I remember bringing on this music director, who's brilliant, and he starts doing stuff that I've never thought of. And it's better than anything that I thought. And I realized I didn't have to tell him anything from that point on. I remember the same thing with the bass player that I've been playing with like 20 years. I first played with Chris. I had all these ideas of bass lines in my head, and Chris starts playing. I'm like, oh, that's just better than anything I came up with. And so what I've recognized is in the professional world, when you bring on somebody that truly gets what you're doing, very quickly, they're going to start to contribute things that you've never thought of that are actually better than what your instinct is. So I always want to solve it in my head. And then I see what people bring to the table. And if that's better than what I had, and I see that a few times, that's my signal to let go and enjoy. Like, they got it. Like give them what they need. Yeah. So I didn't learn that in business. I learned that in art.
I think the most important things I've ever learned in business weren't in business. So I appreciate that as well.
End of the day, this is all about humans, right? I think a startup is a passion project that multiple people come together on and want to make real. You love a startup into reality. You will a startup into reality. It's one of those things that if you stop, it stops. It does not have a life or a momentum of its own. And so, end of the day, the most important job of a leader is to create the weather and make sure that that weather is fertile for creation of the business. Because as you get bigger, you're not in every conversation, you're not in every room. So you want everybody on the team to understand where things are going, and you want to create the weather, the environment where they can communicate with each other freely and openly to say, this isn't working, we're doing the wrong thing, and this could be the right thing, let's investigate that. And if you as a founder can build that room where you're hearing people who are really trying, who are putting their thinking hats on, it changes the entire game.
Thank you, Dimitri. That's amazing. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.